never happened. Nobody looked over his shoulder, way up here. He said Latin Mass if he felt like it, and for several months the previous winter had turned the altar away from the congregation and conducted the mysteries with a sort of wizardy flourish, Angus said. When it came to teaching catechism, he added subject matter or dismissed it. Saturday morning, he let me into the church basement and told me to take a seat in the cafeteria. I did, trying not to look down at the rug and think of Cappy, Bugger Poirier, reforming again after years of stumblebum life in the cities, was the only other student in the dim room. He was a skinny, sorrowful man, with a fat purple clown nose of a long-time drinker. His sisters had dressed him in clean clothes, but he still smelled musty, like he'd been sleeping in a moldy corner. I looked over the handouts and listened to Father Travis talk about each member of the Holy Trinity. After class was done and Bugger wandered off, I asked Father Travis if I could take personal instruction all next week. Do you have some goal in mind? I want to be confirmed by the end of summer. We get one visit from the bishop in the spring, and everybody gets confirmed at that time. Father Travis looked me over. What's your rush?
It would help things.
What things?
Things at home, maybe, if I could pray.
You can pray without being confirmed. He handed me a pamphlet. Plus, he said, you can pray by just talking to God. You can use your own words, Joe. You don't have to be confirmed in order to pray.
Father, I have a question.
He waited. I heard a phrase mentioned long ago and had stored it in my mind. I asked, what are sins crying out to heaven for vengeance? He cocked his head to the side as though he was listening to a sound I couldn't hear. Then he flipped through his catechism book and pointed out the definition. The sins that cried out for vengeance were murder, sodomy, defrauding a laborer, oppressing the poor. I thought I knew what sodomy was and believed it included rape. So my thoughts were covered by church doctrine, a fact I had found out the very first day.
Thanks, I said to Father Travis. I'll see you Monday.
He nodded, his eyes thoughtful. Yes, I'm sure you will. On Sunday, I sat through Mass with Angus, and on Monday morning, I was at church right after breakfast. It was raining again, and I had eaten a huge bowl of my mother's oatmeal. It had weighed me down on my bike and sat warm and heavy in my stomach now. I wanted to go back to sleep, and so, probably, did Father Travis. He looked pallid, and maybe hadn't slept so well. He hadn't shaved yet. The skin beneath his eyes was blue, and the coffee was harsh on his breath. The cafeteria counter was stacked with neatly boxed-up food, and the trash cans were stuffed. "Was there a wake down here?" I asked. "Mr. Poirier's mother died." "Which means we have probably seen the last of him. He was hoping to reconcile with the church while she was still conscious. By the way, I have a book for you." He handed me a soft old splayed paperback of Dune. "So, shall we start with the Eucharist? I saw you at Mass with Angus. Did you understand what was happening?" I had memorized the pamphlet, so I said yes. "Can you tell me?" There was a sharing of the grace-producing food of our souls. "Very good. Anything else?" "The body and blood of Christ were present in the wine and crackers." "Communion wafers, yes. Anything else?" As I racked my mind, the rain quit. A sudden flare of sunshine hit the dusty glass of the basement windows and spun motes of dust in the air. The basement was aslant with shimmering veils of light.
Spiritual nutrition?
Right. Father Travis smiled at the dancing slashes of air around us and up at the windows. "Since it's just us two, would you say we take our class outside?" I followed Father Travis up the steps, out the side door, and along the path that led through the dripping pines.
The grass path made a loop behind the gym and school, down through the rows of trees and over again to the road where Cappy and Father Travis had made the most dramatic part of their run. As we walked, he told me that in order to prepare for the Eucharist, when I would become part of the mystical body of Christ, I would have to purify myself via the sacrament of confession. In order to purify yourself, you have to understand yourself, Father Travis went on. Everything out in the world is also in you. Good, bad, evil, perfection, death, everything. So we study our souls. All right, I said faintly. Look, Father, there's a gopher. Yes. He stopped and looked at me. How's your soul doing? I glanced around as if my soul would appear so I could check on it. But there was only Father Travis's carefully plain, too handsome face, his grave, pale eyes shining uncannily, his sculpted lips. I don't know, I said. I'd like to shoot some gophers. He started walking again, and from time to time I glanced at him, but he didn't speak. Finally, when we turned into the trees, he said, evil. What? We've got to address the problem of evil in order to understand your soul or any other human soul. Okay. There are types of evil. Did you know that? There is material evil. That's what causes suffering without reference to humans but gravely affecting humans. Disease and poverty, calamities of any natural sort, material evils. These we can't do anything about. We have to accept that their existence is a mystery to us. Moral evil is different. It is caused by human beings. A person does something deliberately to another person to cause pain and torment. That is a moral evil. Now, you came up here, Joe, to investigate your soul, hoping to get closer to God, because God is all good, all powerful, all healing, all merciful, and so on. He paused. Right, I said. So you have to wonder why a being of this immensity and power would allow this outrage. That one human being should be allowed by God to directly harm another human being. Something hurt in me, shot straight through me. I kept walking, my head down. The only answer to this, and it isn't an entire answer, said Father Travis, is that God made human beings free agents. We are able to choose good over evil, but the opposite too. And in order to protect our human freedom, God doesn't often, very often at least, intervene. God can't do that without taking away our moral freedom. Do you see? No, but yeah. The only thing that God can do, and does all the time, is to draw good from any evil situation. I went cold. He does, said Father Travis, his voice rising a little. In every instance, Joe, and every heart-soaking instance. As the priest here you know well, I have buried infants and whole families killed in car accidents, and young people who made terrible choices, and even people who got lucky enough to die old. Yes, I've seen it. Every time there is an evil, much good comes of it. People in these circumstances choose to do an extra amount of good, show unusual love, become stronger in their devotion to Jesus or to their own favorite saint, or attain an unusual communion of some sort in their family. I have seen it in people who go their own ways, your traditionals, and never come to Mass except for funerals. I admire them. They come to the wakes, even if they are so poor they have nothing. They give the last of their nothing to another human. We are never so poor that we cannot bless another human, are we? So it is that every evil, whether moral or material, results in good. You'll see. I stopped walking. I looked at the field, not at Father Travis. I shifted the book he'd given me from hand to hand. I felt like throwing it. Gophers were popping up and down, uttering their cheerful tweets. "I'd sure like to shoot some gophers," I said through my teeth. "We won't be doing that, Joe," said Father Travis. Our dusty old midsummer reservation town sparkled all washed clean as I rode down the hill, past the BIA houses, up the road past the water tower place toward the Lafrenais spread. There were three Lafrenais allotments bordering on one another, and although they were divided many times, they never did go out of the family. The houses were connected by threads of roads and trails, but Doe's was the main house, the ranch style closest to the road, and Cappy was there leaning on the deck rail with his shirt open and a set of free weights on the decking by his feet. I stopped, sat back on my bike seat. "Any girls come by to watch you pump iron?" "Nobody came by," said Cappy. "Nobody worth this vision." He pretended to rip his shirt open and pounded his smooth chest. He was better since last week. He had gotten two letters from Zalia. "Here." He made me come up on the deck and lift his weights for a while. "You should get your dad to buy you some weights. You can lift in your bedroom until you're presentable." "Presentable like you think you are. Is there any beer?" "Better than that," said Cappy. He reached into his jeans pocket and took out a sandwich bag rolled carefully around a lone joint. "Hey, blood brother. Me spark 'em up, Kemosabe," said Cappy. We decided to smoke it on the overlook. If we walked along the spine of a small wooded ridge down Cappy's road, we could climb to a higher spot from which we could see the golf course from close up, though we were hidden. We had watched the earnest players before, Indians and whites, as they wiggled their hips, gave shrewd looks, swung well or disastrously. Everything they did was funny, puffing out their chests or smashing down their golf clubs. We always watched the arc of the ball in case they couldn't find it. We still had our bucket full of golf balls. Cappy put some bannock, two soft apples, pop, plus a lone beer in a plastic bag and tied it to his handlebars. We rode off, dragged our bikes into the brush at the turnoff, and walked up the hill and along the ridge to our lookout spot. The ground was almost dry. The rain had sucked into the porous leaves and thirsty earth. The ticks were mostly gone. We leaned our backs against an oak tree that gave perfect shade. I held the joint too long. "Quit chiefing it," said Cappy. I got lost in my thinking. The weed was harsh and stale. We drank the beer. A little party of big-bellied men in white hats and yellow shirts, a team of some sort, came into view and we laughed at every move they made. But they were good golfers and didn't lose any golf balls. There was a lull after they passed. We smoked the roach and ate the tar bits with our food. Cappy turned to me. His hair was so long now, he flung it back with a certain headshake. Angus and Zack were already trying to fling the hair from their eyes, but couldn't bring off the imitation. It was a gesture sure to drive girls crazy. "How come you went to Mass and took catechism from that asshole?" "News flies fast," I said. "Yeah," said Cappy, "it sure does." "He wouldn't let up." "Why?" He asked again. "Wouldn't you think," I said, "a guy whose mom suffered what she did and the skin of evil shows up?" "The skin of evil? Oh, yeah. The tough guy who killed Yar? So, Lark?" "For no reason, the skin of evil shows up in the fucking grocery and his dad has a fucking heart attack trying to kill him. Wouldn't you think that a kid who witnessed all this would need spiritual help?" Cappy looked me over.
Nah.
Right. I brooded down at the clipped green for a while. Nah, he said again. There's something else. Okay, I said. I needed practice shooting. Like I thought he'd let me help shoot the gophers. But he just gave me a book. Cappy laughed.
You dumbass.
Yeah, I imitated Father Travis talking. We won't be doing that, Joe. Good will always come out of evil. You'll see.
You'll see?
He said that?
Yeah,
buttfucker. If that was true, all good things would start in bad things. If you want to shoot, said Cappy, you could have gone to your uncle. I'm off, Whitey. Better me. You should have come to me. Anytime, anytime, my brother. I've been hunting since I was 2. I got my first buck when I was 9. I know it. But it wasn't just shooting gophers, you know that.
I might know that.
You know what it is, what I'm talking about?
I do.
I guess I do. Cappy nodded, looking down at a new set of gophers, Indian ones this time who didn't match. So if you know, you also know I won't implicate anybody else.
Implicate? Big lawyer word.
Should I define it? Fuck you. I'm your best friend. I'm your number one. I'm your number one, too. I do it alone or I don't do it.
Cappy laughed.
He reached around to his back pocket suddenly and took out a squashed pack of his brother's cigarettes.
Shit. I forgot about these.
They were crumpled but not torn apart. This time I noticed the matches had Whitey's station on them.
Now he's got matches, I said.
My brother got them. I never went there, but Randall said he's moving on. He's going to rent out movies. Anyway, back to the subject.
What subject?
I don't need to know. We'll take my dad's deer rifle out and practice. Because, Joe, you can't hit the side of a truck.
Maybe not.
And then where would you be when the side of the truck gets pissed off and runs you down? Shit out of luck. I can't let that happen to you.
Except his rifle. I can't use his rifle.
Just to practice. Then Dole's gun gets stolen while we're gone. While the house is empty, we hide the gun, the ammunition. And we're not here anyway to laugh at geezers, are we?
No.
We're scouting, in case he comes along. I know he golfs. Used to, anyway. Linda told me.
Everybody knows Lark golfs, which is good. Anyone can miss a deer and hit a golfer.
We rode back to Cappy's and went out back where Cappy had started practicing when he was 5 years old.
My dad taught me on a 22, said Cappy. Just gophers or squirrels. Hardly no kick to speak of.
Then the first time we went deer hunting, he hands me his 30-06. I tell him, I'm worried it'll kick, but he says no more than the 22. I promise you, my boy, just go easy. So I get my first deer in one shot. Know why?
'Cause you're an emperor?
No, my son, because I didn't feel the kick. I wasn't worried about the kick. I shot smooth.
Sometimes you learn on a 30-06 and flinch while you jerk the trigger.
'Cause you can't help anticipate the kick. I wish I could teach you on a 22 like my dad did, but you're ruined already.
I did feel ruined. I knew I'd jerk the trigger. Knew I'd flinch. Knew how awkwardly I'd work the bolt action. How I'd probably jam it up. Knew how I might as well cross my eyes as sight a target.
There was a rail fence where we set out cans and shot them down. And set up cans and shot them down. Cappy shot the first one off neatly, showing me exactly how. But I couldn't hit a single one of the rest. I was probably the only boy on the whole reservation who couldn't shoot. My father hadn't cared, but Whitey had tried to teach me. I was just no good at it. I couldn't aim straight.
Looky, you're not an old-time Indian. You would have starved, said Cappy.
Maybe I need glasses. I was discouraged. Maybe you should close one eye. I'm doing that. The other eye.
Both eyes?
Yeah, you might do better. I hit 3 out of 10. I shot until we used most of the expensive ammunition, a problem, as Cappy pointed out. We couldn't let anybody know I was practicing. He couldn't ask Doe for ammunition without explaining why. We also decided I should only practice when there was nobody home. In fact, Cappy said we had to find a more remote place for me to practice. We could go 2 pastures over and be out of sight, although people would hear us. We have to get money, though. Hitch over to Hoop Dance to get a ride. We'll go into the hardware and I'll buy the ammo. No, I said. I should go myself. So we argued back and forth until I had to leave. I had strict hours. My mother had told me she would send the police out after me if I was not home at 6.
The police?
Just a figure of speech, she said. Maybe Uncle Edward. You wouldn't want him out looking for you, would you? No, I didn't want Uncle Edward out looking for me in his big car, riding slow and rolling down his window, questioning everyone who happened to be out. So I went home. I had the money that Sonya left me. $100 hidden in my closet in that folder labeled homework. Thinking of Sonya was like punching a bruise. As I rode back, I decided on a plan to get my mother to drive me to Hoop Dance. She still thought I was taking catechism classes. I needed candles, maybe. Or dress shoes to be an altar boy. The shoes were a good touch. After work the next day, she drove me to the shoe store and bought the dress shoes, which I regretted for the waste of money. But I got into the hardware store and sporting goods store on a casual excuse, and she waited outside while I bought $40 worth of ammunition for Doe's rifle. The clerk did not know me and examined the large bill closely. I looked over at the paints, the basketballs and baseballs, the golf corner, the nail bins, spools of wire at the home canning section, the shovels, rakes, chainsaws, and I noticed gas cans for sale, exactly like the one I'd found in the lake. I guess it's okay, the clerk said, giving me change. When I came back out, I told my mother that I bought a surprise for Dad, who was supposed to take it easy. Besides the ammo, I had bought spinners for bass, our favorite fish to catch. I was building lie upon lie, and it all came naturally to me as honesty once had. As we were driving home, I realized that my deceits were of no consequence, as I was dedicated to a purpose which I named in my mind, not vengeance, but justice. Sins crying out to heaven for justice. I might have murmured this aloud. I was in a kind of trance, looking at the road, imagining the amount of practice it would take. What did you say? My mother had kept that edge. She was protective of my father, and it gave her an intent authority. But more than that, there was what she had told me in Fargo when she put down the hamburger. I will be the one. No, you won't, I thought. But she was keen as a blade. As if during the time she laid dull in her closed room, she had actually been sharpening herself. And then in Fargo, we talked about Dad, about things the doctors said. We weighed facts and questions together. She had treated me like someone older than I was, and this, too, had continued. She saw too much, didn't have the same mild patience with me. She had quit indulging me, never laughed at things I did. It was as if she had expected me to grow up in those weeks, and now to not need her. If she expected me to act alone on my instincts, I was doing just that. But I still needed her. I had needed her to drive me to Hoop Dance. No, I needed her in ways that now were lost to me. On the drive back from Hoop Dance that day, After I had muttered that phrase about sins crying out to heaven, I asked her directly the thing my father would not ask. It was a childish thing, but also grown up. "Mom," I said, "why couldn't you have lied? Why couldn't you have said..." That sack slipped. "You stumbled over something, and you put your hand up, pulled it out, saw the ground, that you knew where it happened. It wouldn't matter where, if you had just said where." She was quiet for so long that I thought she wouldn't answer. I felt no anger from her, no surprise, no embarrassment, merely a period of concentration. "I wish I knew," she said at last, "why I could not lie. Last week in the hospital, I sat there looking at your father, and I suddenly wished that I had lied from the beginning. I wish I had lied, Joe. But I didn't know where it happened. And your father knew I didn't know. And you knew, too. I told you both. How could I change my story later on? Commit perjury? And remember, I knew that I didn't know, too, what would happen to my sense of who I am. But if I had understood all that would come of my not knowing exactly what happened, him going free, him with the sick gall to show himself, I would have." "I'm glad you would have." She looked straight ahead. Clearly, she was done talking. I looked at the road coming at us, thinking. If you had lied, if you had changed your story, so what? You're my mom. I'd love you. Dad would love you. You lied to save Mela and her baby. You did that easy. If they could prosecute Lyndon Lark, I would not have to lie about the ammunition or practice to do what someone had to do, and quickly, before my mother figured out her version of stopping him, there was no one else who could do it. I saw that. I was only 13, and if I got caught, I would only be subject to juvenile justice laws. Not to mention, there were clearly extenuating circumstances. My lawyer could point out my good grades and use that good kid reputation I had apparently developed. Yet, it was not that I wanted to do it, or even thought I could do it. I was a bad shot and knew that. I might not get much better. Plus, the reality of the thing. So I didn't let the whole of it enter my mind at any one time. I only let one piece and then another piece fall into place. We fell silent again. After a while, I realized the next piece. I was going to have to go to Linda Wishkop. I was going to have to find out if her brother played golf anymore, for sure, and if he had some kind of schedule. I was going to have to get some soft and spotted bananas, or buy some firm bananas, and allow them strategically to rot. 3 days of shooting practice later, I showed up at the post office with a bag of bananas I'd watched carefully in my room. They were soft and spotted, but not black. Linda peered over the scale at her window, her round eyes glistening, and that unbearable doggy grin. I bought 6 stamps for Cappy and gave her the bag of bananas. She took the bag with her chubby little paws, and when she opened it, her whole face glowed as though I'd given her something precious. "Are they from your mother?" "No," I said, "from me." She flushed with pleasure and wonder. "They are perfect," she said. "I'll bake when I get home and drop them by tomorrow after work." I laughed. I learned from my mistake with Father Travis that unusual politeness from a boy my age is an instant suspicion raiser. I would have to maintain my course until the moment was right. I would have to have more than one conversation, maybe several conversations, before I would dare fit in a question or two about Linda's brother. So I made sure I was hanging around the house the next day at 5 o'clock when Linda pulled her car into the driveway. I looked out the window and said to Dad, "There's Linda. I'll bet you a buck she has banana bread." "You win," he said without looking up. He was sipping water, reading yesterday's Fargo Forum. Mom walked downstairs. She was wearing black pants and a pink T-shirt. Her hair was fluffy and tinted to a shiny darkness. She wore black and pink beaded earrings, and her feet were bare. I saw she painted her toenails pink. There was the subtle coloring of makeup, her features more dramatic, and that light lemon lotion as she passed by. I got close to her, stood behind her as she opened the door and accepted the familiar foil brick. She was dressing up for Dad. I wasn't too dumb to figure that out. She was looking nice to keep his spirits up. Linda entered, sat down in the living room, and Dad put down his newspaper. "Joe, here's another loaf for you." Pulled another brick from the bag. She didn't thank me for the bananas in front of my parents, which surprised me. Most grown-ups think everything a young person does should be common knowledge. They brag about the slightest gesture from a boy. I'd been prepared to play down my banana giving. But Linda didn't put me in that position. She did, however, start in on the weather chatter with my father, just the way they had before. They pulled out their favorite all-eternal commonplace choked subject. Sure enough, my mother folded and went into the kitchen to make tea and slice up the banana bread. I decided to try a whole other ploy and sat down across from them on the couch. Sooner or later, they would slog through the atmosphere and say something important, or Dad would leave and I could bring up golf. They were on rain, inches fallen in which county, and whether we might see hail. They got to hail they'd seen in various forms of hail damage when I yawned, lay back, and closed my eyes. I pretended to fall into a deep, impermeable slumber, twitching once and then breathing with such deep regularity I was sure they would be convinced. I let myself go limp and heavy. They were talking hail big as golf balls, perfectly round as peas, hail that penetrated roof shingles like BB shot. The couch was wide, the pillows giving. I woke an hour later. Mom was calling my name softly, sitting on the edge of the couch, patting my shin. As happens sometimes, drifting out of an unexpected sleep, I did not know exactly where I was. I kept my eyes closed. My mother's voice and the childhood sensation of her hand stroking my ankle, which was always how she woke me, flooded me with peace. I allowed my consciousness to sink to an even younger hiding place where nothing could touch me. When I finally did wake, all was dark, the house silent. Pearl panted in her sleep. Curled on the braided oval rug across the room. A knitted afghan had been thrown over me. I'd kicked it off, and I was cold. I had missed supper and was hungry, so I wrapped myself in the afghan and padded into the kitchen. Pearl rose and followed me. A tinfoil cover plate of food glinted on the table. The moon was full again, and the kitchen was alive with pale energy. Now that I have lived some, I understand what happened to me in the kitchen that night, and why it happened when it happened. During my sleep, I dropped my guard. The thoughts that protected my thoughts had fallen away. I was left with my real thoughts, my knowledge of what I planned. With those thoughts came fear. I had never really been afraid before. Not for myself. For my mother and father, yes. But that fear had been shared and immediate, not secret. and my worst terrors of loss had not materialized. Though damaged, my parents were sleeping upstairs in the same room, the same bed. But I understood their peace was temporary. Lark would appear again, unless they found Mela dead, or she showed up alive and filed a kidnapping charge. He was free to walk this earth. I had to do what I had to do. This act was before me, in the uncanny light, a sense of dread so overwhelmed me that tears started in my eyes, and a single choking sound, a sob maybe, a wrench of hurt, burst from my chest. I crossed my fists in the knitting and squeezed them against my heart. I didn't want to blurt out the sound. I didn't want to give a voice to this roil of sensation, but I was naked and tiny before its power. I had no choice. I muffled the sounds I made so that I alone could hear them come out of me, gross and foreign. I lay on the floor, let fear cover me, and I tried to keep breathing while it shook me like a dog shakes a rat. I lay under this spell for maybe half an hour. And then it went away. I hadn't known whether it would or not. I had clenched my whole body so tightly that it hurt to let go. I was sore when I got up off the floor like an old man with joint pains. I shuffled slowly up the stairs to my bed. Pearl had stayed by me all along. She huddled next to me. I kept her with me now. As I fell into a darker sleep, I understood that I had learned something. Now that I knew fear, I also knew it was not permanent. As powerful as it was, its grip on me would loosen. It would pass. I could not use the bananas a second time, so I decided to run into Linda around noon. I knew that she brought her own lunch most days, but treated herself once a week to what women always got at Mighty's. The soup and salad bar. I checked the window every day, or went inside and had a great pop. On the third day, I saw Linda approach the cafe with her cheerful Tonka truck walk. She waved at Bugger, who was sitting on the narrow strip of stained grass between the two buildings. She stopped and gave him a cigarette. It was a surprise to me that she smoked. But I found out later she carried around a pack just to give a mooch to people when they asked. I parked my bike where I could see it from inside and followed her in. Of course, she knew everyone and talked to everyone. She didn't notice me until she sat down. I pretended to suddenly see her. Her eyes popped with the thrill of it. Joe! I came over and stood looking around, as if for my friends, until she asked if I was hungry. Kinda. Then sit down. She ordered a shrimp basket. Then, without asking me, another shrimp basket. The most expensive thing on the menu. And a coffee for herself, and a glass of milk for me, because I was growing right before her eyes. I shrugged. I tried to look trapped as I sat there. Don't worry, said Linda. When your buddies show up, you can go sit with them. I won't mind. Geez, I said. I didn't mean to. Anyway, thanks. I only had enough for a pop. Do you always get the shrimp basket?
I never do.
Linda twinkled at me. It's kind of a treat. It's a special day, Joe. It is my birthday. I told her happy birthday. Then it occurred to me, this was her twin brother's birthday, too. Could I bring him up? Then I remember something about the story of her birth. Wasn't it winter, though, when the two of you were born? Why, yes. You've got a good memory. But I was only physically born that day, you see. The way my life has gone, I was born several other times. I picked a date out of those important turning points to be my birthday. I nodded. Snow Goodchild brought our drinks. I could hear the sizzle of our shrimps and fries. All of a sudden, I was very hungry. I was happy that Linda was buying me lunch. I forgot I hated her, and remembered that I liked talking to her, and that she had always loved my parents, and was trying to help even now. The tense prickling left my throat. The right moment would come for questions. I took a drink of cold milk, and then a drink of cold water from the ripply plastic glasses. What day did you pick? The day that Betty brought you home from the hospital? No, said Linda. I picked the day the social worker brought me home the second time. It was marked on Betty's calendar. She only put the most special things on her calendar, so I knew she loved me, Joe. That's good, I said. Then I didn't know what to say. We were in a grown-up conversation, and I could only go so far. I was stuck. I expected Linda would ask me either how my summer was going, or if I was looking forward to getting back to school, the way grown-ups were doing, if they did not ask after my dad. Nobody ever asked after my mother, exactly. Instead, they made some comment. I saw your mother going into work, or I saw your mother at the gas station. The tribal council had given Lark notice that he was barred from the reservation, but there was really no way that could be enforced. It wouldn't work any better than the persuasion. When people said they saw my mother, it meant they were keeping an eye out for her. I thought that Linda might make such a comment, but she startled me. Listen, Joe, I've got to tell you this. I am sorry that I saved my brother's life. I wish that he was dead. There. I said it. I paused a moment and then said, Me too. Linda nodded and looked at her hands. Her eyes popped again. Joe, he says he's going to get rich. He says he'll never have to work again. He's sure he'll have money in the bank now, he says, and he's going to fix up the house and live here forever.
Oh?
I was dizzy at the thought of Sonya. That was all in a phone message on my machine. He said a woman would give it to him in exchange for something, and he laughed. No, she won't, I said. My brain cleared, and I saw the broken bottle on Sonya's side table. I saw the look on her face when she threw her red Sonya bag down. Lark would not get to her. These are grown-up things, said Linda. They probably make no sense to you. That don't make sense to me either. Our shrimp baskets came, and she tried to put ketchup on the side. She shook the bottle with both hands, like a little kid. I took the bottle from her and hit the bottom carefully with the heel of my hand. The way my father did, setting a precise glop of ketchup down. Oh, I can never do that, said Linda. This is the way I put some ketchup on my plate. Linda nodded and tried the technique. You learn something new, she said, and we started eating, piling the little plastic-looking pink tails at the sides of our baskets. What she'd said about her brother was so full of adult complexity that it threw me off. This was not the way I meant to bring up Lyndon Lark. I didn't know if I could take any more information, so I said the safest thing to deflect her honesty. Wow! It's hot. But she wouldn't go to the weather with me. She nodded, closed her eyes, and said, as she ate her birthday shrimp. Slow down, Linda, she told herself. She laughed and dabbed her lips. I've got to do this, I thought. Okay, I said. I get it about your brother, sure. Now he thinks he'll be a rich piece of scum. I'm just wondering, though, could you tell me when he plays golf? If he does play golf anymore? She kept her napkin at her lips and blinked at me over the white paper. I mean, I said, I need to know because... I crammed a fistful of fries into my mouth and chewed and thought furiously. Because what if my dad wants to go golf or something? I was thinking it would be good for him to golf, We can't run the risk of Lark being out there, too.
Oh, gosh, said Linda. She looked panicked. I never thought about that, Joe. I don't know how often, but yes, Lyndon does golf, and he likes to get out there very early. Right after the course opens at 7 a.m. Because he doesn't sleep hardly. Not that I know his habits anymore. I should talk to your...
No.
How come? We were frozen, staring across the food. This time I picked up 2 shrimp and ate each one, frowning, and picked apart their tails, and ate that little bit too. This is something I want to do on my own. A father and son thing. A surprise. Uncle Edward has golf clubs. I'm sure he'll let us use them. We'll go out there. Just me and Dad. It's something I want to do, okay? Oh, certainly, that's nice, Joe.
I ate so quickly, in relief, that I finished the whole plate and even ate some of Linda's fries and the remains of her salad before I understood I had all I needed. The information and an agreement to keep it secret, which gave me both a sense of relief and the return of that whirling dread.
Bugger floated by the window. He was riding my bicycle. I have to go, I said to Linda. Thank you, but Bugger's stealing my bike. I ran outside and caught up to Bugger, who was only halfway across the parking lot. He meandered along slowly, and he didn't get off the bike. Just glanced at me with his wobbly eye. I walked beside him. I actually didn't mind walking because I didn't feel so well. I'd eaten so much, so fast. Maybe on a nervous stomach like my father sometimes said he did. Plus, after all, those frozen shrimp had traveled a couple of thousand miles from where they had started to land on my plate. I had to cover the piled tails with a napkin while Linda waited for the check. Now the walk seemed better than the jolting of a bicycle. I wanted to get away from other people, too, in case I had to puke. As I walked beside Bugger in the hot sun, I started feeling better, and within a mile I was okay. Bugger didn't seem to have a destination that made any sense to me.
Can I have my bike now?
I've got to get somewhere first, he said.
Where?
I need to see if it was just a dream.
What was just a dream?
What I saw was just a dream. I need to see.
Whatever it was, I said. You snaked out. Can I have my bike?
Bugger was getting too far out of town, going the opposite of the way to Cappy's house. I was worried that he might swerve into a passing car, so I persuaded him to turn around by talking up Grandma Ignatia and her generous handouts.
True. A man gets hungry from all his bicycling, said Bugger.
We got to the senior citizens, and he dropped the bike in front of me. He staggered away like a man in the grip of a magnetic force. I turned around and rode back to Cappy's. We had planned to practice shooting, but Randall was there, off work early, fixing his busso at the kitchen table. The long, elegant eagle feathers were carefully spread out from the circle where they joined, and he was working on a loose one. Randall had a handsome traditional powwow outfit, which he had mostly inherited from his father, though his aunties had beaded flower patterns on the velvet armbands and aprons. When he was all fitted out, he was a magnificent picture. All kinds of ordinary and extraordinary things had gone into his regalia. 2 giant golden eagle tail feathers topped his roach, his headpiece, stabilized by lengths of a car antenna. The feathers bobbed on the springs of ballpoint pens. The elastic garters of one aunt's old girdle were covered with deerskin and sewn with ankle bells. He had a dance stick that was supposedly taken from a Dakota warrior, though it was actually made in boarding school shop class. Wherever the components of Randall's outfit had originated, they were all adapted to him now, each feather fixed and strengthened with carved splinters of wood and Elmer's glue, the soles of his moccasins soled and resoled with rawhide. Randall won prize money sometimes, but he danced because Doe had danced,
and also because those moving pieces caught girls' eyes pretty good. He was getting ready for our annual summer powwow this coming weekend. Doe, as usual, would be up behind the MC's microphone making jokes and making sure that things ran along, as he always said, in a good way. "Come on, let's go pick grandfather's for Randall's sweat lodge," said Cappy. "We always put down tobacco for those ancient rocks. That's why they were grandfather's. We didn't always get the rocks. We like being fire keepers better." But Randall had promised if Cappy could start his old red res car, he could drive it. There was a collapsed, gravelly place on their land that filled with water in the spring and had the right kind of stones if you kicked around for them. Randall always needed a specific number, dictated by the type of sweat he would give. We dragged an old plastic toboggan out to collect the rocks. It took a while to find. There had to be a certain kind of rock that would not crack too easily or explode when red-hot and splashed with water in the sweat lodge pit. There had to be a certain size that Randall could pick off our shovel with his deer antlers. Finding 28 grandfathers was a good afternoon's work, and more often, especially if Randall was in a hurry, we'd go out to the rock piles in the fields off reservation and load up Doe's pickup. But this time we needed to be alone. I told Cappy what I'd learned from Linda about the morning golf. Cappy kicked his feet around in the grass and bent to dislodge a rounded gray rock. "You gotta move then," Cappy said, "before Lark changes his habits. You should take Doe's rifle while we're at the powwow." Just to think about stealing from Doe gave me a black sinking feeling, and those shrimp began to perk around in my gut. But Cappy was right. "You have to break in between 8 and 10 on Saturday night," said Cappy. "There's the off chance that Doe or Randall will need to come back for something after they retire the flags. But for sure, Randall will be out there pounding his hooves until then, or snagging. And for sure, Dad can't leave that microphone. So you go in, Joe. And I really mean break in. Leave a mess. You gotta take a crowbar to the closet where the guns are. I've thought about this. And steal a couple of other things or pretend to, like the TV." "I can't carry that." "Just unplug it. Knock the junk off it. Take Randall's boombox." "No, you'll have that. Take the good toolbox. But leave it scattered on the porch like a passing car scared you off." "Yeah. And then the gun. Make sure you get the right one from the closet. I'll show you." "Okay. And you bring a couple of black plastic bags to wrap it in because you're going to hide it."
"I can't bring it home," I said. "I'll have to hide it someplace else."
"Like the overlook in the brush behind the oak tree," said Cappy. After we piled the grandfathers by the fire pit, we spent the rest of the afternoon marking out the trail I'd use and deciding on a hiding place that I could find in the dark. The moon was going to be 3/4, but of course there might be a cloud cover. We wanted to make sure I could do it all without using a flashlight. And also, after that, I would have to make it to the powwow grounds 3 miles away, walking fields and trails without using my bike so nobody would see me. I'd camped out for the last 2 years with Cappy's family, an RV for the ants and a tent for the men, a fire. Randall teepee creeping, sneaking off. We'd wake up in the morning next to him passed out, scented low with some girl's perfume. My parents would expect that I'd go again this year, and even if they said no this time, I'd slip out anyway. I had to. Those shrimp or something else I'd eaten stayed with me all that week. I felt sick when I looked at food and dizzy when I looked at my mother or my father. So I didn't look at anyone and hardly ate. Mostly I slept. I fell asleep like I was knocked out and couldn't get out of bed in the morning. Once on waking, I picked up the book Father Travis had given me. Dune was a fat paperback with 3 black figures walking a desert beneath a massive rock.
I opened it at random and read something about a boy filled with a terrible sense of purpose. I flung the book across the room and left it there. Many months after that morning, I would read that book once, then again, and again. It was the only book I read for a solid year. My mother said I must be getting my growth. I overheard her, or listened in on her. Eavesdropping was a habit now. My sneaking came of needing to know that there was no other way that I had to do this. If Lark moved or skipped out, or was poisoned like a dog, or caught for some reason, I would be free. But I didn't trust my parents to tell me any of these things, so I had to slip behind doors and sit underneath open windows and listen, never hearing what I wanted. Of course, Powwow Weekend came. Mom and Dad had agreed to let me camp out with those boys, as they said, and I hitched a ride out with them in back of Rando's pickup, sitting on my sleeping bag. $5 in my pocket for food. Randall drove us so fast on the gravel road that our teeth clacked and we nearly bounced out of the back, but we got there in time to set up in our usual place. Cappy's family always parked their RV to the south at the edge of the powwow camp circle, right up against the unmowed fields. At that time of the year, the hay was usually ready to cut again. Standing at the edge of the grass, I watched it ripple gently up a soft rise, parting and reparting like a woman's hair. The family liked camping at the edge so they could get away from what Suzette and Josie called the goings-on. Doe's sisters were stout and jolly. They danced women's traditional, and when they were getting ready in their small RV camper, it shook with their heavy movements and bursts of laughter. Their husbands did not dance, but helped out with the organization and security. The first thing we did on arriving was lift the webbed lawn chairs out of the back of the pickup. We decided where to dig a fire pit and put the lawn chairs up around the hole. It was important to have a little place where visitors could come and get brewed tea or drink Kool-Aid from one of the giant plastic thermos jugs Suzette and Josie filled before they came. They also had coolers, one stuffed with sandwiches, pickles, tubs of baked beans and potato salad, bannock, jelly, crab apples, blocks of commodity cheese. The other cooler was full of hot dogs and cold fried rabbit. Soon, around the camp, Suzette and Josie's married children started pulling up in their low-slung old cars. When the car doors opened, the grandchildren bounced out like super balls. They gathered other children from the neighboring camps and moved through the powwow grounds in a tornado of whirling hair and chasing legs and pumping arms. Occasionally, an announcement came over the loudspeaker. These were just test announcements. Doe did not come on for real until noon. He did the welcome several times and reminded dancers that grand entry was at 1. "Put on your dancing shoes." His announcer voice was smooth as warm maple syrup. He loved to say, "Oh, mercy," as well as, "Gee, Willigers." "I'll be doggone," and "ho-wah." He loved to joke. His jokes were friendly and awful. "Just yesterday, a white guy asked me if I was a real Indian. 'No,' I said. 'Columbus goofed up. The real Indians are in India. I'm a genuine Chippewa.'" "Chippewa what?" "How come you got no braids?" "They got chipped off," I told him. "The old word for us is Anishinaabe, you know." "Sometimes you can't tell a real Anishinaabe woman something. She gives you that look, and you got to tell her everything." Doe announced lost children. "Papoose on the loose. Here's a little boy looking for his family. Don't be scared when you come claim him, Mama. He's not covered with war paint. It's just ketchup and mustard. He's been fixing himself to face the 5th Cavalry over at the hot dog stand." When he introduced the drums, he rolled one to the next with a good word for each. "Bear tail, enemy wind, green river, The bleachers started filling with people, and Suzette and Josie sent their husbands to set up lawn chairs at the edge of the arena on the south side to avoid the long and blinding brilliance of the sun as it would set, it seemed, forever into the night. Cappy